like a convection oven.
It is.
Dry.
That's a delightful place. During the winter months, it's worth making the trip.
And we do have a plus on.
Okay.
Am I in trouble already?
All right, we'll go ahead. We've already been called into our open meeting earlier this morning, so we'll resume the meeting here. We want to start by welcoming some new regents. Our new student regent over here, Shiva Motsafari. We're delighted to have you with us from the University of Utah. And we welcome you. We also have Lisa Michelle Church. There you are. And we're really delighted to have Lisa Michelle with us. And Alan Hall down at the end here. And Crystal Magalette. She's back here. Crystal has been nominated, but hasn't had her confirmation hearing. That'll happen this month. So she's here joining us, but we look forward to having you with us. And feel free to join us up here at the table, even though you won't be able to vote. But we'd like to start by inviting Shiva and Lisa Michelle and Alan. If you'll come up here, we're going to administer an oath of office to you. It's always exciting. We already miss those who departed at our last meeting, but we can see that we're in really good shape with some great new energy and exciting ideas that they've already been demonstrating in our meetings this morning. We're going to turn the time over to Assistant Commissioner Jeff Landward, who's going to review some roles and responsibilities of regents and trustees. So, Jeff?
Thank you. In your folders and in the online, you'll find a document called Summary Roles and Authority of UC Governing Administrative Officers. And this is a table, it's blue and gray, that outlines the authorities and roles of the institutional boards of trustees and the State Board of Regents. Now, by statute, the Board of Regents is given the authority to administer the system of higher education, but also has the authority to delegate certain responsibilities to the institutional boards of trustees. This table uses policy and statute to outline what those delegations are and what you've retained for yourselves as regents. Rather than go through the entire table with you for the sake of time, I'm just going to refer you to this document. And if you have any questions about any of those roles or responsibilities, please feel free to find me. But otherwise, it is there for your use. Incidentally, this is an area that we have identified that will require some renewed attention from the Board of Regents as we look to determine what the appropriate balance of authorities and responsibilities are between the regents and the trustees. And so we'll be coming back to this subject in future meetings to go through it more thoroughly.
Okay, any questions now? And otherwise, feel free to contact Jeff at a later time, and He's a great resource, and especially for those who are new on the board. If you have any questions about governance issues, et cetera, Jeff Landward is your resource. I'll turn the time over to Commissioner Wilson, who by the way, we want to welcome in his first meeting. We're delighted to have him. Should have started right up front with that, but we're really pleased to have Dave Wolstenholm here with us in his role as interim commissioner. He's just been fabulous right out of the gates, helping with a lot of ideas and energy, and we're really pleased to have you with us, so I'll turn the time over to you.
Thanks, Chair Simmons. So just to follow up on a couple of things Jeff said with the missions and roles of the institutions, we've identified this one in the office, one of the top projects that we'll be working on over the next couple of months is to really dig into the roles and missions of each of the institutions and identify what those are, how do we best benefit students throughout the state. And so we'll have region involvement, obviously, your staff as well, as we really look into that over the next couple of months. I think it's an area which we really need to define. It's an area that we need to get much better at and put some energy and emphasis into. So look forward to those discussions as we move forward. The other thing that we recognized as a staff as we came in is we'd like to have more time with the board. And I know you guys have already put in a ton of time and a ton of energy, but I think our committee work is really valuable to some of the things that we want to move forward as a system. And so as you can look at the agenda, what we've asked is in the off months when we're not meeting as a committee of the whole is that we meet as a in your committees over IVC or over Zoom or on the telephone, however we can do it, to where we're not all having to commute, but we all have an opportunity to really take some time and dig into some of the tough issues that we need to address in those committees. The other thing that will be valuable as we do that, some of the things in the committee that you would like to move just to the consent calendar, you'll have the opportunity to do that working with your committee. If it's something that's not really controversial, if it's something that you feel like that you've worked out pretty well as a committee, we can move that over onto the consent calendar and then give us more time in our meeting as the whole really to discuss some of the topics that we need everybody's input on. And so hopefully that'll free up a little bit of time in our regular meetings as well to really dive into some of the bigger projects, bigger things that we want to do as a system. So again, if it's something that we want to take off the consent calendar, Jeff tells me we'll have that opportunity in the meeting to remove it from the consent calendar so we can have more discussion as the committee as a whole. But hopefully that'll work for all of you. We also recognize that maybe not all of you will be able to attend all those committee meetings, but every effort that you could make to get on your calendar and to really be involved in those committees, that would be very helpful. Also, next to that agenda item on your agenda are the new committees that have been formed. I met with Vice Chair Barnes as well as Chair Simmons and really try to organize the committees to where they made sense, hopefully areas of where you have some interest, areas that you'd like to serve. And so hopefully as we break into committees today, we can make the committee work very engaging and hopefully be able to cover some of the topics that we have.
You want to talk about the new committee?
Yeah, and so in just a few minutes, we're going to have each of the committees report out in my other presentation about kind of what they see as some of the top priorities in the committees. We want to make sure that the people working on those committees know exactly what are the top priorities. And you'll have an opportunity today in the committee work as well to define what some of those top priorities are. We've taken what we think we've heard from you in the past and what the committees have heard from the past, reprioritized those, and then really try to hit the main things that this body has wanted to move forward in the past. One of the things that we realized that we probably didn't have enough effort in is workforce and advocacy. So we've got a new committee that is set to do that. We're really thankful for Regent Anderson and she's going to lead that committee, and Regent Jensen will be the vice chair of that committee. And we're really happy about their leadership, and also Carrie Main and Melanie Heath will be the staff that works on that committee. But one of the things that I think this system has not had and has not got recognized for is what we provide in workforce. And that goes from our CTE programs, clear up through our engineering programs and other programs that really is contributing to workforce. So we'll be working on the workforce stuff there as well as some advocacy for the system to highlight some of those things that are going on. And not only that, but some of the things that we need to be doing much better.
Okay. Any questions? Yes. President.
Commissioner, I'm just wondering the role of the presidents, if any, on the committees. We typically have just come when we have a meeting to the ones maybe where we have an action item. But in the interim, if it's possible to see agendas in advance, so, and are we welcome
yes.
to join a committee if we've got something on the agenda?
Thank you. That's a very good point, President Hoffman. Absolutely. We'd love to have the presidents there and those from your staff that you think is going to be vital to that discussion as well. So we'll be sending those agendas out a week in advance to the presidents, and you hopefully will get the right people to attend those meetings. My thought with that is we ought to have the very best minds around the table as we discuss this, even if they're not part of that committee. But if we're talking something that really involves your institution, which is probably most of the time all of you, and you have some experts in that area, we want to make sure that's the case. We recognize that we do not have all the expertise in the commissioner's office. You have a lot of the expertise out at your individual campuses, right? We need to be bringing the best and the brightest minds to the table to discuss and do that. So please, as you get those agendas, scrub them over, look at them. We'll actually probably even be sending out to you, hey, we'd really like to have so-and-so attend this, if they could free up their schedule to do that. We know for those individuals that you think may be there, you may want to have them put a hold on their, you've got the agenda now, you got the schedule when those are going to be. You may want to have them put a hold on their calendar now. So if it's, excuse me, so if it's something that does pertain to them, that they're free to be able to attend. Good question.
I just wanted to add on that. I really like the idea of streamlining these meetings. So any other committee meetings that we're assigned to will also try to be on that same day. So as far as efficiencies and logistics, I think that streamlines the meetings. So thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on that item? If not, Commissioner, would you like to talk about this overview of priorities in your office?
You bet. I just got the slides. Can we pull the slides up? Oh, there we go. So yeah, what this is going to be is just a quick report. First of all, I really want to thank my office staff as I've made this transition over the last month. They have all been more than willing to rethink of the way we've been doing things in the past and really think about ways that we should be maybe doing things in the future. And all of them have been very engaged with that. And I very much appreciate their willingness to kind of reset and to think about things that have worked well and maybe things that we could definitely improve on. And all of them have done that with really an open mind of how do we best serve the students and the institutions of the state of Utah. So this will kind of be a report of some of the things that we've thought of, some of the things that we think that we can serve our institutions and the regions in a better way. One of the things that we know, and I think the discussion yesterday, hopefully everybody enjoyed that discussion, one of the things that we felt very important as I went into the office is we really needed to have a discussion about the commission, about the legislative study, about where we're going with that, what that's going to look like, how is higher ed going to play into that. So hopefully everybody had an opportunity to discuss that and at your tables yesterday and discuss that as a group. I know there's probably a lot of unanswered questions, right? How many of you feel like that? I think all of us feel like that a little bit, is there's still a lot of unanswered questions to look at. The thing that I took away from that, and the thing I took away from that in the last month while I've been in the office, is the fact that we have a lot of work internally to do before we worry too much about the study. And I hear you, we need to worry about the study, we need to be able to make sure we have a major involvement in that as it's laid out. In fact, this group should really be steering a lot of those discussions that go on, and I will make sure that we have an opportunity to do that as that study comes out and we get that first draft report, that each of you will have an opportunity to give input and maybe hopefully directed where that's going. But we do definitely have some internal things that we can be working on, things that we can be improving, so whatever does come out of that study, we're more prepared as a system, and we really can lead the charge of higher education in the state of Utah. I think the future of higher education is bright, but I do think there's a lot of things that we need to work on, right, and to improve, and to even the image of higher education and where we're going. And so we'll be working very strategically and focused on where that needs to go. One of the things that we've thought a lot about in the office is what is the purpose of the commissioner's office and what really should be our role. We've embarked on an opportunity to go out and take my executive team out to each of the institutions. We've done that to four institutions at this point. Had an opportunity to spend 3 or 4 hours with them and their executive team, The other four will be doing this month, here in the next week or two. And we've really gained some great insights from those institutions of how the commissioner's office can better serve those institutions. And to me, that's what it's all about in the commissioner's office. Obviously, we have the responsibility to carry out the direction of the regents, but it's really about serving those institutions. If you look at who provides the service to those students, it's the institutions. And so whatever we can do at the system level to make sure the institutions have what they need and how we can best support them in doing that is where we really want to direct the direction of our office. One of the things that we've recognized as well, at times I think we've got somewhat scattered on our different priorities that we're working on as the system. So one of the things we really want to do is to really get strategically focused on where do we need to move the needle right now? Where do we really need to focus our energies as a commissioner staff and as the institutions to really move things forward in the state of Utah? So we want to make sure that we are the facilitators and we facilitate that, but we want to make sure that we're focused so that we do know, everybody knows. One of the things I think came out very clear, and I wrote in my notes yesterday, is the communication maybe has not always been there across the entire system the way it probably should be. And that's part of being strategically focused so that everybody knows what we're working on. Everybody knows we're working on it together. And I think together with the eight institutions and the commissioner's office, we can hit those high marks that we really want to focus on and we really want to hit. One of the things that we looked at as we reorganized the office, and I'll show you the reorganization here in just a second, is we looked at statute. What is required by the Board of Regents? What is really the purpose of the Board of Regents? What are you required to do from statute? And then also we've looked at what are some of the initiatives that the regents have wanted to move forward. And we recognized quite soon in the office that we probably wasn't organized in the way that we needed to be organized to make sure we're hitting on all these areas. And so that's the reason the organization, we didn't just come in and say, oh man, I like this person or I like that person. It was more around what is it we're trying to accomplish and how do we organize the system in a way that we can accomplish those goals of both the legislative mandates, but also, and just as importantly, the goals and the vision of what the regents have for the system. This is just a quick look of the updated Board of Regents committee. We worked with, again, with the chair and vice chair to make sure that these committees were aligned. We had the right people working on these committees. We appreciate those chairs of the committees that have agreed to chair the committees. But this, I think, will align it to where we can really hit on those high points that you've been focused on as a Board of Regents. We won't go through all these. I think all of you probably know by statute the Board shall, and this is all in statute. This is some of the responsibilities of the Board of Regents given to you by the governor and the legislature, things that this body should be addressing. And as we looked at each one of these, we ask ourselves, are we aligned in the office to make sure that we can hit on each one of these? We recognized, like I said before, real quickly, that we probably could be organized better to accomplish that. I want you to look at the numbers and the lettering over on the left. In this next chart that I show you, we've identified each one of these areas that we should be hitting on and what committee should be doing that work. And you'll be discussing that today in your committee meetings. And I know that's hard to see, but you can see the different committees that are there, and then in the orange down below, you can see each one of those items by statute that the committee should be focused on and working on. When I looked at those, what was really interesting to me, what's in statute and what you've identified of regents are very similar. In fact, they're in line with one another. So I think the focus has been right. I think the focus is where it needs to be. I think we just need to really ramp up our efforts in each one of these areas. You can see that organizationally, and I won't go through each one of them, but organizationally, there's been some changes to try to align people and their strengths in each of those areas and where they'll be working on in the committees to make that happen. Any questions on that? Again, I could take an hour and go through each one of these and explain why we did what we did, but if there's not any questions, we'll just move on. One of the things that I'm really excited about, President Cockett's already given me a hard time about my little lapel pin here I have on. He wants to know why Utah State colors are not on that. But with that, I'm going to turn that over to Melanie and let her answer those hard questions. But I'm really excited about the rebranding that has taken place before I even got to the office. But I think they've done a wonderful job with it, and we'll let Melanie walk us through that.
Hi, thanks. You may have noticed that your board materials are a little... Can y'all hear me? that your board materials are a little different this time. So we're really excited to roll out a rebrand for the Utah System of Higher Education. Just a quick reminder of what we were working with beforehand. It was a little antiquated, contained a tagline that we didn't really utilize, and just the size of the logo was a little difficult to put on documents and those kinds of things. So this is the new logo. We're very excited about it. It was very intentional in how we thought through this. Our guiding principles were we wanted it to be simple, modern, and kind of easy to understand quickly. The graphic element of the logo is, I think, really representative of what our system is. It's a circle. It says that we're all working together. It kind of evokes a gear, which is another thing that we were excited about.
See, I was suspicious. This is Dave's UTEC background. A gear from a transmission.
Well, that's because we provide so much of the tech ed in the state, right?
So if you'll notice the colors, we wanted to keep them fairly primary colors and really basic. Also, we tried not to be specific to one institution in our color choice, so we landed on these. If you'll notice the colors, how they're disaggregated, so we have 4 blue, 2 green, and 2 yellow. And that is aligned with the missions of our institution. So we have 4 regionals, 2 research, and 2 community colleges. So, we're really excited about this and feel like it looks modern and simple. Another change is we updated our board seal. One interesting thing to note is we'd like to use, when we talk about the Board of Regents, we'd like to talk about it as the Yushi Board of Regents. A couple other states do that. I know Nevada. And I do think it helps to align kind of the two organizations more intentionally by bringing both of the names together. We also have a new website. It is at yushi.edu, so it has a new domain name. You may have to clear your cache to make that appear. Again, the design behind it was really simple. I don't know if you can see at the top, but we ordered the menu. It's initiatives and then reports and data and then Board of Regents and Office of the Commissioner. And we purposefully did that because we wanted to show what we do and then talk about who we are. And so I think that's a very nice integration into what we do. And then you'll also see that we have new templates for all of our reports that are coming to y'all. So we do believe that this is going to be a really streamlined and kind of easy to digest look for the reports that you'll get. Lastly, I wanted to give a big shout out to Jenna Erickson and Trisha Dugovic. They're on the communications team at Yushi, and they have worked their tails off to get this done by today. So I don't know if this is too forward, but I'm hoping we can give them a round of applause because they have done an incredible job. So thanks.
Thanks, Melanie. The other thing I would like to do, if we go back to the committees, I would like each of the office staff that's working within these committees to talk a little bit about their priorities and where we're going. And so, Melanie, if you and Carrie want to talk about your committee first, and then we'll just kind of go through the list.
Sure. We're really excited for the Workforce Access and Advocacy Committee. It's a bit of a mouthful. In looking at our committees, we realized that the other two committees that have been longstanding are pretty institution-facing, and it felt important that we have a committee that was more external-facing, so dealing with populations before and as they enter into higher education, and then on connecting with them as they leave higher education, so kind of the inputs and outputs there. We also know that those are our most external-facing audiences, that's also naturally where we advocate. One thing that we're going to be really focusing on is the report that y'all have received, which is Utah's Growing Opportunity Gap. So we do believe that a lot of the work in our committee will be focused on within that context. So I don't know if you had anything to add.
I would add that for the workforce component, We want to make a connection point between the voice of the regents and your expertise as people who are out in industry and where we are working with state partners who are building out on workforce development. So we want to ensure that when we are sitting at a workforce development board or we're part of a panel choosing grants for strategic workforce initiatives, we understand the Board of Regents and their priorities, and we implement those priorities as we're making our decisions and giving our expert input into those decisions.
And kind of to add on to that external stakeholder piece, at the beginning, we want to work really intentionally with the State Board of Ed and others to make sure that we're all working together as we help students make the transition from high school to college. So it's going to be fun.
Any questions for Carrie or Melanie? Okay, Rich.
Thank you. So, there we go. So the Finance and Facilities Committee, I think all it takes is a look at our agenda for today, and you can see the work that our committee does, that it's a full packed agenda, that plenty of discussion on budget. And what our committee is focused on are the three main priorities assigned to us by the code that the commissioner just went over. And so the biggest one is to come up with a unified budget, finance, and capital plan for the system. And so you'll see that most of our meetings discuss some form of that, whether it's tuition, whether it's fees, capital, land, property, all of those issues. The second statutory responsibility is to look at opportunities for efficiency within the system, something our committee is looking at and has looked at. And the final one is metrics, performance metrics. And I'll discuss this more in just a minute, how we're looking at performance funding and some of those issues.
Great. And Liz.
So the Academic and Student Affairs Committee, I think, is the longest standing committee of the Board of Regents, at least in the same form as it's always been. It's kind of the heart of the institution, academic pathways and student support to reach the end of those pathways. In the committee meeting today, we'll look over the overview and committee description that identifies all the statutory requirements that we have in academic and student affairs, which is oversight of institutional missions and service regions and quality of academic programs, leadership on college preparedness and academic pathways to college and through college, efficiency, transferability of degree pathways, and supporting students' efficient and effective progression to award completion within the system. So those are statutory requirements that the committee oversees. We have some really exciting things that we're working on in the committee. Transfer and articulation is probably top of mind. Competency-based education and prior learning assessment are statutory requirements that we're addressing. And analytics-driven student success are among the things we're going to talk about and our charges to the committee.
Thanks, Liz. And I failed to mention that Regent Clyde will be chairing the Finance and Facilities, and Regent Jones will be chairing the Student Success, so Academic and Student Affairs Committee. So with that, that concludes my report, Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there any comments or questions for the commissioner? A lot of work. Appreciate that. We will now hear from Associate Commissioner Rich Amon on budget prioritization guidelines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as the slide presentations put up on the screen, the intention of this portion of the agenda was to give the full committee an overview of what we'll capture a little bit more in depth in our Finance and Facilities Committee, and then what will come back to the full board for action. And the main topic for this discussion is budget. So we're putting together the framework for the budget for fiscal year 21, which, if you think about it, it's a full year away. It's July 1st of 2020 is when that starts. So what we're doing is we're putting the framework together today, And then the actual budget will be voted on and reviewed in September, with institutions having the opportunity to provide their actual needs and their requests to the full Board of Regents. And so I'll go over kind of this framework, of which the biggest piece is performance funding. And so I'll talk about the current model, some opportunities we have maybe to improve that model, and then I'll finally discuss capital, which is changing significantly with the implementation of Senate Bill 102. And I'll do this very briefly, that our committee will get into more of the detail. So first up, I wanted to talk about performance funding. So this is the current model that without those colors, that table is typically what you would see as a region as you approve the allocation for performance funding every year. And so to walk through this, there's really seven pieces of the performance funding model. I think it's important for you to understand what this is, as it will become a major funding source, we think, for the future. Last year, it was close to $30 million, and going forward, we'll be making similar requests. So it's a significant amount of money that the legislature's put aside for performance. So first off, the first number is measures. So there's five measures. You can see what those are: completion, underserved, etc. So the legislature has put these into statute, very well defined in the statute, very kind of concrete. The second piece is the weight. So the legislature's given the regents the ability to weight those different measures according to their thoughts on different priorities. Third is then the actual appropriation allocation. This is statutorily driven, where so if the legislature puts a pot of money, say $30 million for performance funding, it's allocated by a formula that's in statute that's based, half of it is based on student enrollment, so FTE, full-time students, and the other half is based on the budget. So institutions all, there's eight different ways that pot of money is divided. They have that pot for themselves that they're able to earn, which is number five, the progress measure. Again, a very statutorily kind of concrete issue that it requires a 1% improvement every year in each of those metrics. And doesn't look at different missions or any nuances in the different type of metric, just a 1% measure. From there, the award is what the institutions are actually able to receive. What they get if they met that 1% progress measure, and in this case, the U had a completion rate of 3%, so that's greater than 1%, so they got the full award in that area. If they did not, that would be the last piece. It would be the balance. So there would be a piece of unallocated revenue that would then go the next year just as to go back to the pot of money to be allocated. And so we'll go into this in more detail in our committee, but what we wanted to bring up is that we think that there's an opportunity for us to improve this formula, recognizing that it is a substantial funding mechanism going forward in the future. We would recommend that we look at the measures and more flexibility. I guess that would be the key that I communicate, is flexibility outside of statute. When it's in statute, you have to change statute to make an adjustment, right? That we would recommend flexibility for the Board of Regents to look at those measures, and specific to institutional goals and opportunities, as well as in the award, to look at something outside of that 1% or progress measure, I should say, so that the award would be focused on them meeting their own individual goals that they've set. And so this next slide is just a proposal. There's a lot of work to be done. This is just one idea that we'll start, and we'll have a discussion in our committee about this, and with the hope that we continue to have discussions as a board and with legislators of how we might improve this model. Our suggestion is that the regents look at kind of a longer-term horizon, say a five-year look at a important metrics for the board. We have identified here three that we think are important of timely completion, not just the completion of students, but the timely completion, workforce alignment, which currently exists, and the college going rate, the participation in our system, that we'd then look at, under this proposal, we'd have the regents work with institutions to set aligned goals with those metrics, as well as choose from two others that would be institutional specific, that could be research for the research institutions or for others, their underserved or other opportunities. And then it would go through this process. So this is kind of a discussion item, just to have you start thinking about this, and we'll have a broader conversation in our own committee. That gets us to the real purpose of today's meeting, is to set up the budget guidelines. Similar to what we did in May for capital, where we put together the framework of the capital requests, this is the framework for the budget requests that would be due in late August, so that we would have it for the September meeting. And so the three main areas that we're focusing on from our office that we are suggesting for the board to adopt would be to have regent priority initiatives as the first box to look at, some system-wide initiatives such as the college access advisors. The second piece would be compensation, which is significant, going forward asking for compensation for staff and faculty. And the third bucket would be institutional priorities, of which the mechanism we are suggesting would be performance funding, having a request of $34.5 million, which is what the side on the right breaks out. That would be how the current allocation works. And recognizing that even if we were able to change performance funding this year, that it would be so late in the year that we'd be under the same model as we currently are. And so the last piece that I'll just highlight is that there's an asterisk at the bottom that our schools of applied technology, the non-credit bearing programs, we would propose to work with the UTEC system to move forward as budget priorities.
Rich, I just want to comment on that. So that would only be the three institutions by statute that is really fulfilling the role of the tech college. The other institutions may be doing some technical education, but there's a tech college within that region that provides the majority of that. So it would be Salt Lake Community College, USU Eastern, and Snow College by statute that has that responsibility to deliver current technical education.
Can I ask a question, Dave? Does that UTEC budget process have a kind of a cap like we've had the $34 million that we're, do they go in with an umbrella ask?
It's been all over. The years that I was there, their request was right around $10 million.
So are we going to have kind of like we do with this side, a kind of a cap that we would have to...
So I will work with each of the year institutions, and what we do there is we have that spreadsheet that we have you filled out that we provided you already. That so you may want to be expanding your diesel mechanics program. You would put the diesel mechanic, you'd put the dollar amount, the number of students that you need to continue to serve, whether it's just growing your program to serve those students or whether it's a new program that's being implemented, and then we come up with a specific dollar amount. And so instead of having it open like we are in the performance funding, it's more detailed in the programming, and that's been very successful with the legislature as we move forward. Does that answer your question, President?
And the intention with both that and the institutional priorities is for institutions to give us their needs, to have you have the opportunity as presidents to look at your individual needs, and then we'll have a sense for what those are, recognizing that there will be limits to what we'll be able to put forward. But that's where that second piece would be, is if you're asking for a lot of funds outside of what would be available in performance funding or potentially in the tech section, that would be a discussion that we would kind of set up for our March discussion on tuition, if those needs would require you to increase your tuition. And the final thing that I'll just go over is will be on the agenda for the full committee to approve is a policy, R-742, which is our recommendation for the implementation of Senate Bill 102, which is creates a new funding formula for capital facilities, for the buildings in the system. And there's two processes that will continue to operate side by side, and this is the one side that would be driven by a formula of how to allocate $73 million that's ongoing that will be available in 2 years. And the intention is for us to adopt this policy, and that is required by statute to be adopted here in August. But there's still time, there'd be a full year before the funding actually trickles in, that we could, if there's changes to the policy that need to happen, we can continue to have that conversation. But we have a policy that by statute requires us to do two things, to set measures and to set weights to those measures. And so unlike performance funding that is very statutorily driven, this was given us flexibility for us as a system to set those metrics. And I've put up the table that would show, and this is preliminary data, the data will change, but the metrics themselves will be the same moving forward. We'll get into more depth in our committee of what those six are, but you can see three are enrollment, performance metrics, and regional student growth, which are focused on students. The bottom three, square feet per FTE, facility age and condition and utilization, focused on the facility side of institutions. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's kind of an overview of what we'll be covering more in depth in our committee.
Okay, we've got a question from President Calkin.
So Rich, can you return to the green slide?
This slide.
So over under on the left-hand side, you say the regions have three system goals. The first two seem to correspond to what the legislative performance goals are. The third one does not seem to. And then I'm wondering what happens to the other performance funding metrics as well. Sometimes we end up setting different metrics here within USHI and the regions to what the legislators are doing. And then as an institution, I never know which one I'm moving towards.
Thank you for that question, because that's exactly what we want to address here, is we want to align. So if you remember in January, we had a huge discussion about metrics, and we have a bunch of metrics now for the system and institutions. We have what the legislators are looking at. They have performance funding, but they also have things that they look at in their budgets too. The intention with this, and recognizing the details have not been decided on, this is more of a framework discussion, but the idea is to align all of those three so that there's one set. If they're focused on putting money into performance, we think that those metrics all ought to be aligned, and so what we report on ought to be what is ultimately funded. And so that's the intention, is to simplify all this into one model.
President, at the end of the day, we want one set of metrics.
Okay.
Right, so.
And then I'll just point out this college going rate as a responsibility for an institution is tough.
That's right.
I've seen some of that work where we're assigned our service areas, but that does not mean that students necessarily within the service areas go to our institution. And I also am not sure that an institution, a standalone institution, can necessarily influence the college going rate for a certain area.
Right, that's an excellent observation.
Okay.
So there'll be more discussion about that too in the committee today.
That's right, and we're not deciding on anything today. It's more to have a discussion about, more in depth about what we currently have and opportunities going forward. There's still a lot of work that legislators have, some ideas that we'll continue to work on. We want to pull from you and get your ideas as we move forward, that recognizing We'll have from now through session, right, that this will be an ongoing conversation, but it is the top of our priorities, and we want to have that discussion begin today.
And remember, the funding for that we'll be asking for this year will be awarded off of the current performance funding.
Okay, any other questions at this point? At least I understand the work we're trying to initiate here, so. Okay, that it? Thank you very much. We're going to turn the time over to Associate Commissioner Carrie Main, as well as Assistant Commissioners Melanie Heath and Julie Hartley, to talk about this growing opportunity gap we have in the state and the scholarship programs.
As Spencer is queuing up the slides, I'll give an introduction. Pardon me. Thank you for the time to present to you some of the data that we have been looking at here in our office that is going to probably be very influential in some of the decisions we're making. As Commissioner Wolstenholme said, we are really focusing on the future and understanding that higher education needs to adapt to the change that is going on here in the state of Utah. Some of the first data that we've been looking at are population projections that were produced by the University of Utah's Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute. They actually have a populations estimates committee, and higher education is a representative on that committee, where we discuss how best to formulate our population projections. That service is provided by the Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute to give intercensal estimates on populations as we wait for the federal government to produce our decennial census. The most important finding, I believe, coming out of our population projections is that Utah's population and demographic composition is going to go through a significant change over the next 40 years. Where today our minority population makes up approximately 20% of the citizenry in Utah, it will increase to 34% by 2065. That is a significant change. It is not a majority minority at that point in time, but what's probably the most important thing to come out of these estimates is at that point in 2065, our minority population will be contributing one half of the growth that occurs every year. So think of it this way. If you have 100 new citizens in the state of Utah, be it from birth or migration, 50% of those new citizens will be of our minority populations. We should see this as an opportunity, but it's something that we need to reflect upon, look at our policies, and ensure that our policies are going to meet those needs moving forward. We know that those additional citizens will be citizens who need education and will want the resources from higher education. Are we prepared to provide those? So we wanted to look a little bit more closely at how our minority students have been performing in the USHI system. So we took that data and performed an analysis here in the Institutional Research Office. So our staff conducted an analysis using estimates of current enrollment and completion data, marry that with the Gardner Institute's projections. So we're looking at current enrollment rates and current completion rates, and we're dissecting that both by gender and by minority status. And we're looking at the specific outcomes today and asking ourselves, if no intervention exists and things remain as they are today, what would our enrollment and completion story look like in the out years? And as you can probably guess, our enrollment and completion rates for our minority students are and our minority population are far below those of our white population. And so that gap will grow as that proportion of minority population grows in the future. In fact, our estimates tell us that but with no intervention, if things remain as they are today, we would miss out on just under 300,000 degrees and certificates, roughly 290,000 degrees and certificates over the next 45 years. So that's a significant problem that we need to address. And we, along with the Board of Regents, would like to, and the college presidents and all of our partners would like to examine policies that we may be able to adjust or create that would help to ensure that those students have all the access and the support that they need so that we do not forego all of these college degrees and certificates. So one of the places that we are going to take this data is into the Workforce Access and Advocacy Committee and dig a little bit deeper onto that data and say, what can we do to ensure that this data is properly used for policy moving into the future? We've already recognized that this could be very informative data for our state scholarship program. So Julie's going to talk more about how this data is going to influence some of our decisions going forward in that area.
So, given our opportunity to experience growth in the state of Utah that a lot of other states are not blessed with, this is a wonderful time for us to think about how to conceptualize state aid and scholarships in a more strategic way to meet our changing populations and the growth patterns that we're going to be experiencing. So we are going to be engaging in a state scholarship study to make sure that we're really doing what we could be doing most effectively with state aid. And this provides us with a great opportunity to examine all of the various different state aid programs that are out there. Depending on how you define it, there's over 30 that we could look at and see if we're really moving the needle and accomplishing what we want to with these scholarship programs. To help with this study, we are asking you to think about joining our scholarship study task force. We are asking each committee today to pick two members from your committee to serve on the task force. Before you get too excited, we have a very fast timeline going on for the study. We are going to start meeting weekly on Wednesday afternoons beginning on the 14th of August. We're going to meet through the beginning of November. We are hoping to have a plan in place by November so that we can be well positioned going into the legislative session. So it's an ambitious timeline, but I think we can really accomplish a lot. We will be reporting back at the September board meeting on decisions that have been taken to that point. So if you are interested in state aid and how best to address the needs of our students, we hope that you will volunteer in your committees to serve on the task force. Let me just walk you through some of the questions the committee will be addressing, and I unfortunately cannot answer these questions today, but the committee will be doing that, or the task force. So questions we're going to be considering first. What goals and priorities do we want to address with state aid? Because we want to link the funding to the priorities. There are several we could think about. One is aligning state aid with attainment goals. Another is making college affordable. Another is focusing on certain types of credentials or career pathways. Another thing we could target is certain types of students. Once we've figured out the answers to those questions, and we'll be going into a lot of detail about what's going on in the state in terms of those questions and how we might address them. Once we figure out our priorities from question number one, then we can get into the follow-up questions. So question number two, what best practices should we keep in mind when designing scholarships to address the aims that we've identified from question one? Question three, what scholarship or aid programs are already in place in Utah? What gaps exist and where could we have the biggest impact for making a difference on that goal? Once we've determined what we want to do, how much money would we need to adequately fund the program, especially looking at demographic growth going forward? We want the programs to be sustainable. Question five, how will we measure success and communicate it back to stakeholders? And then the less exciting questions, where would the program be administered and by whom? And then, so to kind of give you a sense of who we've already targeted as our victims on the task force, we're hoping for, again, two of you from each committee. There are several people from the commissioner's office who have already been assigned to the task force, and we will be doing a lot of the data and background to help address the questions going forward. Representative Owens, I accidentally appropriated him as a commissioner's staff member. He's not. He's part of the legislature, so sorry about that, Representative Owens. We will also welcome other legislators who might be interested in participating. We'll be having two different financial aid director representatives, we hope. One of them will be from an institution that has been implementing PROMISE programs so that we can think more strategically about PROMISE programs and scaling those up across the state. And then two staff members from the Utah State Board of Education so we can have a public ed perspective too on where our gaps might lie. So if you are interested or if you have questions, please talk to me afterwards, and then please volunteer within your committees.
So just to add, we're excited to talk about these kinds of things in the Workforce Access and Advocacy Committee. One of the action items today will be to not only look through the data in a bit more detail, but then also have you guys direct staff to go back and look at what other types of policies and initiatives can we look at as we're kind of dissecting this data to make sure that we're forward thinking and we'll make the measurable impact that we want.
I have a question. Yeah. So I love that you're data driven and I think that's an amazing challenge, but I really need you to hear from the minority communities. And so I'm hoping we can talk about this in the committee, but I'm hoping with that aggressive Wednesday meeting schedule, we could get some community members in that could say, this is what we want you to target for scholarship aid, or this is how we think retention works for our people, so that we don't think about it in the abstract. So hope you may have already planned on that, but I just wanted to say that to the group.
No, it's a great point. Thank you.
Yeah, and we actually have planned a few listening tours to communities that we will be targeting.
Okay.
So we hope to include those in our very ambitious schedule.
Thanks.
I just wanted to maybe underscore, I think this is really timely and probably a little overdue, but I sit on the Northwest Commission for Colleges and Universities, and they are creating new standards that will go into play. They're voting on them right now. And those standards include disaggregated data on student achievement by race and gender. And so our accreditation will now be, that will be a component of accreditation. So going and getting this data and moving to make sure that we're doing right by those folks is going to be really important.
Good. Yes.
So it also, I really support of this work too, but as we look at the data and as we look at some of our, some of the performance funding criteria, the college going rate and this particular types of students that are coming over the next few years, I'd love to have a lot more, greater understanding of non-traditional students as well, right? So the working learners. So we are talking about, the sort of minority students that we've got to pay attention to, but we actually have a lot more, there's a whole group, right, of students who started college are now mid-career, especially for two-year institutions like Salt Lake and Snow. We really want to take a look at that. So I'd be interested, Carrie, in understanding where that gap is in addition to these other gaps you've identified.
That's great. Thank you for that. Other thoughts? Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Alan Hall, I would love to serve on this committee. This is one of the sort of personal missions, if you will, that I have of helping with student scholarships. So love to be a part of it.
Thank you very much for that. Okay, well, more to come on that, but I think this is really exciting. We're starting to use demographic data coupled with what we know about students to really plan for the future in a way I think we haven't been able to before. This is really a fabulous thing, and thank you so much. We're really pleased with the work. We're going to turn the time over to Associate Commissioner Liz Hitch for a few minutes to talk about institutional missions and roles.
So I have no slides. But you do have a report in your folder. It's a labeled general report, and it's also labeled Utah System of Higher Education Institutional Mission/Program Offerings. As I mentioned when I talked about the work of the Academic and Student Affairs Committee, one of the primary responsibilities is oversight of institutional mission and roles. And we have many new members. We have several members of the Board of Regents that have never served on the Academic and Student Affairs Committee. And so this is just a brief primer on how we are organized statutorily and within region policy, a reminder of how things are right now, so that we are prepared to look at that if there are any changes needed. So if you'll take that report, you'll notice that Utah Code 53B16101 does specify the roles of the institution and of the various institutions, and Regent Policy R312, which you can find online, and there is a link there for that, also highlights the statutory requirements and gives a slightly broader definition of roles and missions. When an institution changes their mission statement, the Board of Regents takes a look at that mission statement in the context of this policy and actually adopts it as a part of this policy. So that's an interesting procedural thing that we do to keep our mission statements current and consistent with the descriptions that we have in the policy. I've taken just a few segments out of here so that you can see how the institutions are organized. And each of the descriptions, we try to talk about what level of academic programs each institution has, the nature of the work of the faculty and staff at that institution, and then we do identify the institutions that fall into that category. So just briefly, our research universities, as you can see, can offer all levels of academic programs, any variety of program that they want, although they do not offer associate degree programs. It isn't specified that they don't, but they don't, at least at the present time. They are focused on teaching, research, and service. Those are classic categories for higher education institutions at the research university level. It also notes that they have the opportunity to do a fair number of grants and contracts, and in fact, that's an important part of their revenue stream. It's not that other institutions don't do that, but the research universities are often focused on that. It supports their research efforts. And so the University of Utah and Utah State University are two research institutions by policy and by statute. The regional universities provide career and technical education, undergraduate, associate, and baccalaureate programs, and select master's degree programs that fill regional or state workforce demands. Some new policy language that went in last year in R312 is identified in that second sentence under 4.2, which talks about the viability of those select master's programs. The chief academic officers were looking for a metric that would help them to make determinations about the viability of master's degree programs at the regional universities and their continuation. And so they asked that we add a minimum average of 5 degrees for those programs. It's a way of their gauging the success of those master's degree programs and whether they want to continue the ones they have in the books or perhaps discontinue those and try others that are more focused on workforce needs and student needs. The regional universities emphasize teaching, scholarship, creative achievements, and complement teaching and community service. And so it's a little different role you can see. It's not just the classic teaching, research, and service, but more focused on community involvement. They have student success and developmental programs and services that you often find in a comprehensive community college. There's been a lot of discussion over the last number of years about dual mission institutions, and they fall in this regional university category. They are Weber State, SUU, UVU, and Dixie State. The comprehensive community colleges are really focused on Associate of Arts and Associate of Science degrees. knowledge and skills offered in those degrees, and they offer Associate of Applied Science degrees, career and technical education, customized training for employees, developmental education, and strong student services to support these functions. I think I remember that President Huftalen wrote that sentence. Make sure that we hit on every one of the important functions of the Comprehensive Community College. Of course, they are focused on successful transfer for students that want to go beyond that work, and they emphasize teaching, training, scholarly, professional, and creative achievement and community service that contributes to their role in the community. And Salt Lake Community College and Snow College are identified in that category. On the second page, we move on to sort of the roles. The institutional boards of trustees approve all degree programs and institutional structures with a few exceptions. This is by statute. Branches, extension centers, colleges, or professional schools must be approved by the Board of Regents. And new programs that are outside of the designated service area of an institution must also be approved by the Board of Regents. In implementing this policy, we identified a number of programs, in fact, pages of programs that were existing outside of service regions for our current institutions, and those were grandfathered at the time that this policy went into place. You can see there are exceptions to the degree level programs, which include the Bachelor of Music with an emphasis in commercial music at Snow, the Bachelor of Software Engineering at Snow, and the Doctor of Nursing Practice that you just approved at Weber State. The designated service areas are identified in Regent Policy R315. Sorry, this is so dry. It's very dry, but it also sets the structure for how we operate. So it's important to know how that works. Our designated service areas are by county, and there is a list in policy that indicates the counties served by each institution. There are some exceptions to designated service areas, which include online courses that are asynchronous. Asynchronous meaning that neither the faculty member nor the student need to be in the same place at the same time. And those are not controlled by service areas. We have self-supporting special contract classes. They often happen at SLCC, I know, where a particular organization wants to have a special course prepared, and the institution does that work on contract for them. I mentioned the grandfathered programs. And then in any case where an institution is in a service region and cannot or wishes not to provide a particular program, but another program, another university is willing to do that, an agreement between the two presidents of the institution can make that happen. So that's a brief overview of how we're organized now relative to institutional mission and roles and service regions and program array. Are there questions? All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very, very much. Do you have a comment?
Yeah. I just wanted to quit. Liz, on the research institutions, they can award associate's degrees, though, right? Is that a clarification we need to make?
You know, it is not, I don't believe, by policy or statute, not allowed, but they don't.
USU does.
USU does through the regionals. I'm sorry.
No, actually,
is that right? Sorry, I misspoke.
No, just so it's clarification.
Yeah, good clarification.
Okay, yes. Yes, yeah, go ahead.
You mentioned earlier USU Eastern, which was two of our campuses, which now aren't both called USU Eastern, offering the CTE programs. Now that was under statute because of the merger with College of Eastern Utah, but would not be reflected in this.
Yeah, in fact, both of those are known now in statute as comprehensive regional colleges. And so there may be actually another classification, Liz, that we need to look at, because in statute, both USU Eastern and USU Blanding are comprehensive regional colleges in statute. What that means is they offer the full smorgasbord of CTE all the way up through the doctorate program.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay, thank you. We're going to circle back, and before we break for lunch, we're really pleased to be here at Southern Utah University, and I want to thank President Wyatt and all of his staff for making this such an enjoyable stay on this campus. I'd like to turn some time over to President Wyatt to talk about what's happening on the campus here.
Well, we're just so delighted to have you here today. This is fun for us to be able to host you here and to kind of show off what's happening and let you see how beautiful the place it is and the dreams that are occurring here. I have a natural affinity to data. It comes from being the son of a scientist philosophy major who went to law school and then became a university president. It's just kind of hardwired, but I'd like to not talk about data or those kinds of things and maybe shift our attention for just a moment on not the how, which we spend all of our time, or measuring what's going on, but maybe to talk about the why, to just kind of remind us what's happening. And to do that, I would love to illustrate it with a little story. The story starts in 1897, when the University of Utah determined to enter into the world of distance education, and to do it in the finest, most advanced technology possible in 19th century America, and that was to build a branch campus. And so it went out for a competitive bid around southern Utah to see who it was that would be able to have a branch campus of the U. And Cedar City won. The condition attached to that was that they had to build a building and dedicate the land on which it sat to the state before they could start the school year. But the 1,200 pioneer residents had no building materials and they had no money. But they were just completing a church building that was called Ward Hall. It was kind of a social civic church combination. And they thought, we can start in this building, and then when we get around to it, we'll build the building that we're required to. That's kind of the classic response that any frontier community would take. So in the fall of 1897, classes began in Southern Utah University, which was Branch Normal School of the University of Utah. This was a group of farmers, ranchers, and miners who had no interest, frankly, in the curriculum that was being offered. There was nothing in the curriculum that helped them be a better farmer or a better rancher or a better miner. But they knew that education was critical for the American dream. They knew that it was important to cultivate and civilize this rural community out in the middle of nowhere. Well, by the time we get through the first semester, the state of Utah discovers the game that was being played, and we were in trouble. And so the mayor shows up on January 1st and announces that his negotiations had failed and that the community had 8 months to build this school and dedicate the land or it was going to another town. It's January 1st. Farmers, ranchers, and miners. This wasn't settled by craftsmen. It wasn't settled by contractors. And they had no building materials because everything that they had gone into this church building. But they couldn't wait till spring. So a group of 11 men and 12 horses went up the hill to what's just beyond present-day Bryanhead. It's 35 miles. Horses don't do well in the snow. And these men had never been on the mountain in the middle of the winter. So what awaited them was all new. As 5 days into this journey, you know, today people can run 35 miles in a day. But 5 days into this journey, they haven't quite gotten to Jensen's sawmill yet to get some lumber to bring down to see if they could start the project. And what happens in all of these stories is that the 100-year storm hit them. And so this snowstorm came in and just pelted them. They described it as snowflakes so large that it felt like they were walking into a white sheet. They couldn't see. They were cold. They were wet, totally ill-prepared. They didn't have clothing to be where they were. And they decided the only thing they could do was try to get out with their lives. And so as they turned to come back down, searching out a rustic cabin that was between where they were and home, they ran into snowdrifts up on the mountain that were so high that they couldn't get through them. The horses were spooked. They couldn't move. And of the 22 horses, as fortune would have it, one horse, a horse known as Old Sorrel, a 1,600-pound draft horse, something that they would be proud to see in the Ogden Rodeo, was able to claw through a drift and provide an opening for everyone's escape. They got through and came down to this cabin. Five other men were on their way up, and they met these 15, 16 people and talked about what to do. They had just barely escaped with their lives. The storm was still coming. Most of them said, it's time to quit, give up. It's just too much. We can't do it. And so 10 went back down the hill. But one of the men, and his picture is right here, if you can see him, the second panel over, bottom right-hand corner, a gentleman by the name of Neil Bladen. Neil said, we are not quitting. And he rallied four of the others, and they went back up the mountain, got their wagons, the horses that they could get, picked up a load of lumber, and think in terms of how much you can get in one wagon. This is a trivial amount of lumber. Loaded up the wagon and came back down. So 2 weeks into the 8 months, almost risking their lives, they show up with a minuscule amount of board feet to start building a building. They don't have a foundation. They don't have rocks for the foundation. They don't have bricks. But when they arrived in Cedar City with boards in tow, it ignited this community. And they went crazy. All of a sudden, women are sewing new clothes for the men. Blacksmiths are building skids for the wagons because wheels don't work in deep snow. People were coming together with food and everything, and the next group of men went back up the mountain. And all of a sudden, women and men are digging clay out of the cold earth so they can fashion bricks. And men are quarrying stones out of the solid, frozen, frigid winter months to get enough material to build a foundation. Because they didn't have the building, the state refused to give any funding at all. And so a number of families in the community mortgaged their homes. This was a grand gamble, to mortgage your home, to pay salaries of faculty members, and to provide some funds for building materials, because they knew if they weren't done by the 1st of September, they lost it all. And men and women left their jobs on the farms and the ranches and the mines and came in and devoted themselves full time for the construction of this building. Well, They made it. They made it. They got it done in time, and Southern Utah University was born. The question can always be asked, why? Why would people give up their jobs to build a school they would never, ever attend? Never. It was a normal school. And the answer is the same answer that you find in communities all over this country and probably all over the world. But we see it in this epic story of the settlement of the West. They had three things at least. One, they wanted to build a society that was equipped to govern themselves. A government that was built on the people had to have a people that could understand critical thinking, how to sort out data, facts, what's true. All of these kinds of things that were essential to govern self. And listening to this data that we were seeing earlier about what's happening in our minority populations, we need to make sure that everyone in our community is prepared to participate fully in this self-governance. Secondly, they wanted to have their children and grandchildren obtain the skills that they could be engaged in the economy, in the workplace, and have a better life than what they had. That was really important to them. And thirdly, and this is what I think is, in my sense, it's kind of one of the my favorite parts of this, I'm convinced they were going after Thomas Jefferson's dream for America. And that dream was life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And for the founders, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was different than what we call happiness today. For them, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness was the ability to think for oneself, to be able to read and understand, to live a fulfilled life of the mind, to understand things, to be able to look up on the hill and say, that mountain is red, that means there's iron there. To go to a Shakespeare play and understand something that deepens us, that connects us with our friends, our neighbors, our community, enriches us as individuals. They wanted us to have all of these things that one might have in an intellectual, cultivated society, and they wanted to build it in this rough, rough part of America, a part of America where they all lived on the land. And my favorite line comes from Ebenezer Bryce, who was a rancher in southern Utah, who said about this beautiful landscape, it's a hell of a place to lose a cow. I mean, we look at it as being so beautiful, but when you were in the 19th century without air conditioning, without Gore-Tex, your clothing didn't work well in the winter down here. It was hard. It was really hard, and it was a hell of a place to lose a cow. Today, we are the beneficiaries of their dream that was a dream for us. Shakespeare has this great play called The Tempest. In The Tempest, there is this beautiful little line that goes, you'll all remember this, but you might remember it slightly differently. We are the stuff of which dreams are made on. Humphrey Bogart got the quote wrong in The Maltese Falcon. He said, the stuff dreams are made of. There's a big difference between being the stuff someone else is making their dream on and being the stuff that someone uses to make a dream. We're the stuff dreams are made on. It's not about us. We are the catalyst to help people realize their dreams, to have a job, to be able to think for themselves, to participate in government, to make our communities, our country, and the world a better place. And there has never been a time in the history of America or the history of the world where this is more important than it is today, I submit. Well, as I look in this room, this is a room of dreams. It used to be the gym where athletic teams, basketball teams won and lost their dreams, where dreams were found when crepe paper was hanging from the ceiling and they were having a prom, a dance. In 1992, this was converted into the hall that it is today. And it's still a place where students' dreams are pursued and found. A lot of our students call this the Harry Potter room. And it's possible that a president has occasionally dressed up like Harry Potter, not like Harry Potter, but like Headmaster Dumbledore, with the help of the Utah Shakespeare Festival costume team. I looked awesome. Right until I opened my mouth, and I don't sound at all like Dumbledore. But these pictures that are in this room are the stuff dreams are made on. A campus is nothing more than a whole bunch of people collected in spaces. And these people that you see here have been the stuff dreams have been made on over and over and over and over again. You see people like Michael O'Levitt, who grew up in this town to a very, very poor family, who now is the namesake of our politics and public service center for students, where they learn these kinds of things and get a head start in their careers. Perhaps our most famous son for this town, who was the Secretary of Health and Human Services. There's people like Grace Tanner, who grew up in Parowan and married O.C. Tanner. We have a Tanner Center here. SUU, along with the University of Utah, Princeton, Oxford, Yale, Berkeley, Cambridge, Michigan, has the Tanner Center. We're the only non-Yale-like school that has one. Really proud of it, and students are learning a great deal about human values because of her gift to this school. Wally Flanagan in the top corner planted all the trees that have become the foundation of the most beautiful, in our humble opinion, the most beautiful campus anywhere. And he didn't see them grow to maturity. It was a dream he had for others to fulfill their dreams. And I could keep going through lots and lots of faces that are on this wall. Two of the people on this wall are the ancestors of two vice presidents here at Southern Utah University, who are the stuff, continuing that stuff that dreams are made on. Annie right here in this beautiful black dress, third panel over top left-hand corner, the first female faculty member at Southern Utah University in 1898. And she started the first women's collegiate basketball team in Utah. If only we had enough time, which we don't. And I think that every institution can do the same thing. Talk about the legends, the stuff on which dreams are made. And all of us in this room constitute that same ethic. We are the stuff on which dreams are made. It's not about us. It's about those who come here, whose dreams are realized as a result of your work. And I just want to thank you all for your service, for being here, and for helping us be the catalyst of this stuff. Thank you.
Thank you very, very, very much. I've always had just one question. That's what, explain Jack Benny up here. Is that
Jack Benny?
So I don't think that's Jack Benny.
It's not Jack Benny. I've always assumed that was Jack Benny.
So Jack Benny is a graduate of SUU.
As of today.
We'll give him an honorary degree.
We need to find out who that is. All right.
Did I mention Fred Adams?
All right, thanks very, very much. Do any of the other presidents, before we break, anything else you'd like to bring up for us before we break for lunch? Yes, President Cockett.
So I just wanted to mention to you folks that USU is working on a new year of. We've had two in the past, year of water and year of the arts, kicking off on August 26th, which actually has a special date of significance. We will be doing the year of the woman. And this will highlight, just as President Wyatt did, some of our most notable women who have helped USU or have graduated from USU or who are particularly noted in their Utah community. We have several exciting events and ways that we'll be doing this, including American Festival Chorus and Orchestra concert put on by Craig Jessup, different kinds of lecture series, both highlighting the women as well as highlighting our women faculty, et cetera. The reason that this becomes an important year to do this is there are two anniversaries that are coming up in 2019-2020, and that is the suffragette movement, which granted women, white women actually, the opportunity to vote in elections. And that was the 100th anniversary in the coming year. But also, Utah had granted women the right to vote 50 years prior to that. And that anniversary will also occur in 2019-2020. So you'll be hearing more of this when we host the Regents and the USU staff at USU in September.
Okay, thank you very much. We look forward to that. Anything else? If not, we're going